This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Soul is nominated for 3 Oscars, including Best Animated Film. It already won the Golden Globe for Best Animated Picture. My guests are the director and co-director of Soul, Pete Docter and Kemp Powers. They co-wrote the film, too. Kemp Powers is also nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for the film One Night in Miami, which he adapted from his play of the same name. Pete Docter wrote and directed Up and Inside Out, which won Oscars for Best Animated Film. He also wrote and directed Monsters, Inc. and co-wrote the screenplays for Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and Wall-E. He's now Chief Creative Officer at Pixar Animation Studios. Let's start with the movie Soul. It's about what makes a life meaningful and what makes us who we are. The main character, Joe Gardner, is a middle school band teacher who feels unfulfilled because his ambition is to be a full-time jazz musician. On the day he's offered a full-time teaching position, he learns of an opening in the band of a jazz legend Joe idolizes. He auditions and, to his amazement, gets the gig, which he thinks will be the beginning of his real life. He's so excited by this dream come true, he pays no attention to where he's walking and falls right into an open manhole. He's transported out of his body onto a conveyor belt to the great beyond, but he refuses to die just as he's about to get his big chance. So he runs in the opposite direction, falls off the conveyor belt into the land of the great before, where his body is in a holding pattern between life and death. Through a series of adventures and mishaps, he has to figure out the purpose of life before he can return to his body. In this scene from early in Soul, Joe Gardner, voiced by Jamie Foxx, is at the piano telling his middle school band students about how he fell in love with jazz when he was a child. The piano part is performed by John Batiste, who also composed and arranged the jazz sections of the score for Soul.
Look, I remember one time my dad took me to this jazz club, and that's the last place I wanted to be. But then I see this guy, and he's playing his chords with force on it. And then with a minor, I was, whoa, whoa, whoa. Then he has the inner voices, and it's like he's singing. And I swear, the next thing I know, it's like he floats off the stage. That guy was lost in the music. He was in it, and he took the rest of us with him. And I wanted to learn how to talk like that. That's when I knew I was born to play. Connie knows what I mean. Right, Connie?
I'm 12.
I love that. Pete Docter, Kemp Powers, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the Oscar nominations and on the win from the Golden Globes. Pete, you originated the story of Soul. What was the germ of the idea?
Well, I started working on it after Inside Out, and it was a kind of a period of some amount of emotional turbulence, and I had always loved animation. You know, I was 9, I think, when I made a flip book and figured out this is what I want to do with my life. And having just finished Inside Out and so much success in the film, I found myself wondering, why don't I feel like my life is all wrapped up and solved in a nice bow? Why didn't it fix everything? And maybe I've been pouring my efforts and focus into the wrong thing. So this film was really an investigation into what's going on in my life, what's going on in the world, and what's life all about.
So why did you make the main character a jazz musician?
Yeah, we experimented with a couple different things. For a while, Joe was an actor, and we found what happened was that the audience, for whatever reason, thought he just wanted fame. So it was just like a selfish goal. But with music, especially jazz music, you know, you don't go into jazz to get rich and famous. You do it because you have this passion and drive to perform this kind of music. There's something that felt noble about it. And then as we learn more about it, jazz as a metaphor for life was just too good to pass up in terms of what we were trying to say in the film.
How did you decide to collaborate with Kemp Powers on the film?
Well, we had made some of these decisions of Joe being a jazz musician, being living in New York. We figured, okay, if this is a film about a jazz musician, our main character should probably reflect that. That seems like the right thing to do. We need some help. We need people who, somebody, ideally it would be a major contributor, the writer, who knows about those things. And so we were really lucky to find Kemp, who not only is all those things, but also is a damn good writer.
Yeah, so does this part get a little awkward, or like you realize you need a black person working on the screenplay with you, and Kemp, you realize when you're called that like you're the black person who's going to help them with it. It's like, I think we recognize that that is what needs to be done, but I think it's like an awkward position for everybody. Like, how do you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty funny because obviously when I got the call from my agent that Pixar was interested, they were looking for a writer to help them with a project, and they're always very cloak and dagger about it. So they wouldn't tell me anything about what the story was about. But of course, the first thing my brain said was, I'm guessing the story must have black people in it. And and you know, I try not to be, I know that can sound cynical, but look, that's just the reality of this industry. That it wasn't very long ago, and when I say not very long ago, I'm talking just like 3 or 4 years ago, where it was very possible if you happened to be white to create and tell a story about anything you wanted to, and no one would so much as push you to even consult with people from that community, let alone invite them in and be partners. So while, you know, it's easy to kind of take the cynical route, I saw it more as a really interesting opportunity, because when I flew up to Pixar and I sat down and I saw the nuggets of what would become Soul, I really fell in love with the story that Pete was trying to tell. And it was a story that felt like it was about me, you know, and it was a story that really wasn't about race. Yes, Soul is a film. The majority of the characters are black, but it's not, quote unquote, a black film. It's this, we're trying to tell this universal story through the specific prism of a black man. And I think that was a really bold choice that I was relishing an opportunity to try to execute.
Were there changes you wanted to make as soon as you started working on it?
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think that's part of what probably, you have to confirm with Pete. I'm sure that's part of what got me hired, is that they showed me a reel. It was about 45 minutes long and I had notes. I mean, I had a lot of thoughts, and there were definitely questions I had about basically this main character, Joe. I think the way I described it, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong, was that in the early reels, he seemed like the least interesting person in the film.
Yeah, it was an interesting concept, but not Joe.
Yeah, Joe just, and part of it was, I think, because there had been such extreme caution and such a fear of doing things that might offend someone or upset someone, that instead there really hadn't been much done. Like, I didn't know anything about the guy. I didn't really know anything about his family. It seemed like Joe was just a very, very lonely man who didn't know anyone and had no friends. And so that just meant that his life had to be filled in. And of course, the nature of being at Pixar is that it doesn't matter whether you're a director or a designer or an artist, you use your life as fuel. So it was very easy for me when you say, oh, he's supposed to be a 45-year-old black man from New York. What a coincidence. That's what I am. To start filling in a lot of those gaps with my own personal experiences.
So what is one of those gaps that you filled in with your own personal experience?
It was honestly the first scene I started working on when I came there. I think the scene is called Suit, and it's when Joe goes to get a suit from his mom, who is a tailor. And a lot of elements of the discussion they have between his mom, who's played by Felicia Rashad Libba, is really just a versions of conversations I've had with my own mother about, like, how long are you going to continue to pursue this writing thing? Pursuing writing as a career can really seem like a fool's errand to people. And understandably so, when you consider the likelihood of having any kind of success at it. And so as you get into your 30s and then get into your 40s, and you still haven't made very much of a dent, a concerned parent is going to really tell you about those concerns.
So we happen to have this scene queued up and ready to go. So let's hear it. So this is Joe, the jazz musician, and his mother, who runs the tailor shop.
Mom, I know we've had some rough times, but you're right. I can't be truthful with you, because it seems like no matter what I do, you disapprove.
Look, I know you love playing.
Then how come except for church, you're the happiest when I don't? I finally land the gig of my life and you're upset.
You didn't see how tough being a musician was on your father. I don't want to see you struggle like that.
So Dad could pursue his dreams and I can't?
Your father had me. Most times, this shop is what paid the bills. So when I'm gone, who's gonna pay yours?
Music is all I think about. From the moment I wake up in the morning to the moment I fall asleep at night.
You can't eat dreams for breakfast, Joey.
Then I don't want to eat. This isn't about my career, Mom. It's my reason for living. And I know Dad felt the same way. I'm just afraid that if I died today, that my life would have amounted to nothing.
Joey.
So, Kim Powers, what was the version of that conversation you had with your mother?
It was several conversations, and the last part where he says, if I die today, I feel like my life would have amounted to nothing. That was something I was saying to myself a few years before when I almost died in a hospital. And I had gotten very, it was right before the opening in Baltimore of my play One Night in Miami, ironically enough. And I'd had an allergic reaction to Tamiflu and ended up coming down with rhabdomyolysis. It's basically your muscles start dissolving and it causes your organs to shut down. And I ended up in the hospital in Baltimore for more than a week. And there was a great concern that my organs were all going to fail. And I was surrounded by my loved ones, you know, and family. And I couldn't move because I was in such pain. I was heavily medicated for the pain. So I was just spent most of the day staring out a window. And I just, this malaise fell over me. And I just was saying to myself over and over again, like, oh, man, like, it's like I've never even, I didn't accomplish anything. It's like I wasn't even here. Like, no one's even going to remember that I was here. And I said to myself that, like, oh, if I make it out of this, then I'm going to, like, go for broke. And it was when I got out of that hospital a few weeks later that I basically turned around. And I was still doing journalism as contract work that I quit my last journalism job and said, I'm not available anymore to do any contract work. I'm really going to kind of pursue this foolish dream of mine of doing my creative writing by going all in. And you know, for my mom, it's one of those things where, like, being a writer all these years, it's embarrassing. You know, you go, you're married, you end up getting divorced, you have kids, and you're getting older and older and still having to go to your mom to, like, borrow money. Because every time there's a big opportunity and you talk about it with such excitement, ultimately something always ends up happening that makes that opportunity not be as lucrative, as fruitful as you expect it to be. It's funny because my mom she called me up a couple of weeks ago. She was pretty upset with me because when we won the Golden Globe for Soul, I hadn't told her. Because I've gotten into the habit of not bringing up what I'm doing anymore, just because of so many years of always saying I've got this thing and it never. And so my mom was like, I had a she was like, a friend of mine calls me up and says, congrats to your son. He won the Golden Globe. And she's like, you know, I had to pretend like I knew what she was talking about. So, yeah, it's.
well, I hope you told her about the Oscar nominations, plural.
I believe she knows now.
Okay, good, good. I think I need to reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guests are Pete Docter and Kemp Powers, the director and co-director of the film Soul, which they also co-wrote. It's nominated for 3 Oscars, including Best Animated Film. Powers is also nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for One Night in Miami, which he adapted from his play of the same name. Kemp Powers, I want to ask you about One Night in Miami. It's about the night that Muhammad Ali won the heavyweight championship, defeating Sonny Liston. And then there was a gathering in the Hampton House Motel of Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown, as a football player. You've written this whole dialogue for them, this whole conversation in which they talk about like the great issues facing them as individuals and facing the civil rights movement and, you know, the more radical black movement that Malcolm X is a part of. How much did you actually know about what happened when they all got together?
Honestly, just little tidbits in terms of the actual discussion in the room. There, I mean, if you read biographies on each of the four men, if you read enough of them like I have, there will be references to details of that night, them being in quiet conversation, them just having vanilla ice cream to eat, which is a detail that I put into the film script. But when I wrote it, I wanted to really position this more as historical fiction, because it was really less about what they actually said that night to me and more about what each of these men represented. And the discussion that I wanted these characterizations of them to have is a discussion that black men have been having since way before that night and are still having to this day, black people in general. And it's what, if any, social responsibility does a black public figure have, whether it be a black athlete, a black politician, a black singer, a black artist? What, if any, public responsibility do you have? And it just so happened that these four men represent very clear, very distinct ideas about how much or how little you have. And again, when I first found out that this was a real night, my intention was to write a book about their friendship. So I went down this path of doing years of research to write a book that I never got around to writing. And then as my career in journalism ended and my creative writing career picked up, the very thing that had stymied me from writing the book, which was not being able to fill in that blank, was really the perfect setup for what initially what was a stage play to debate these things with, like I said, characterizations based on everything that I really knew about each of the four men.
Have you answered the question you posed for yourself, like how much of your work should be in service of the larger movement?
Well, for me, I think I never don't think about personal and social responsibility. It's never not on my mind. And in terms of how much, it's very situational. That's why when I wrote that film, I didn't want an audience to come away from it feeling like the central argument, so to speak, is between Malcolm X and Sam Cooke. And I didn't want audiences to leave feeling that one person was necessarily right and the other person was necessarily wrong, because the answer is very situational. I think that in order for us to, as a people, to get where we need to be, we need both Sam Cooks, which means people who are willing to suffer and work within the system to bring about change that you might not immediately see, but that's change that's happening. And then you also need Malcolm X's, people who are willing to confront the problem publicly and burn the whole system down and start over if need be. There's very different tactics. And I think that their debate is in many ways an internal monologue. It's the debate that goes on inside my psyche now that I'm a very public artist. It's a debate that happens before I decide which projects I'm going to take on, which things I want to really commit myself to. And I think it was I'm really happy that the play version of that story was actually one of the couple of things that Pete and the folks at Pixar read before they brought me on to Soul, because I felt like, okay, if they've read One Night in Miami, they should know that I'm going to really be speaking up if there are issues that I find objectionable about certain elements of characterization.
Pete, what did you find relevant in One Night in Miami to Soul?
I just felt like Kemp's ability to take these themes and argue both sides of it was exactly what we were looking to do in the film, and portray them through such strongly opinionated and clear characters, you know, because of course the characters are the voice of the author, and in all these things is like the audience experiences it through those characters, and they were just so cleanly and clearly defined. It was really great. I think we read the play version, because of course the film one hadn't, you hadn't even started writing it, had you?
I turned in the first draft the week I started at Pixar.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it wasn't done yet.
It's kind of interesting that one night in Miami and the U.S. versus Billie Holiday and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, three Oscar-nominated movies, are all based on real people. And there seems to be kind of a trend of a lot of African-American-themed films being about real events in history or real people, you know, including yours, One Night in Miami. And I'm wondering, like, if you have any thoughts about why that is.
Honestly, I was wondering that one myself. Maybe it's universal consciousness. I'm assuming a lot of it probably has to do with Trump's presidency. I was having a conversation with another black filmmaker about this fairly recently, and just this idea that it feels like as a nation we're going through such a moment of crucible change. So it's pretty easy to, you know, look at other moments of crucible change in our own nation's history, and the 60s in particular really jump out because first, like, you know, we're so familiar with so many of these people, so many of them are our heroes and our icons, but there's also always lessons to be learned from their experiences, and in some cases, lessons that it's very evident that we have not learned as a country, you know. And that's not to say that we haven't had progress. Of course, we've had incredible, you know, progress. When the night that One Night in Miami took place, Miami was still segregated. These men actually had to stay in the black part of town. They didn't have a choice. So it's not to say there hasn't been immense progress, but it does point out just how bad things can get when the pendulum swings in the other direction. And it does feel like there have been some massive pendulum swings. And then the last presidency, I think this is just my theory, maybe got artists kind of examining that a little bit more. But remember, I first wrote the play back in 2013. So this predated, you know, Black Lives Matter, and it predated all these movements. So it's really hard to say.
Well, good luck to both of you at the Oscars, and thank you so much for talking with us. It's just been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you.
Pete Docter and Kemp Powers co-wrote the film Soul, which Docter directed and Powers co-directed. Soul is nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Film. Powers is also nominated for an Oscar for his One Night in Miami screenplay, which he adapted from his play of the same name. We've all heard the phrase, the unexamined life is not worth living. But what about the overly examined life? Can thinking too much drain the pleasure out of life? Our book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Life of the Mind, a wry debut novel that mulls over those very questions and more.
The opening scene of Christine Smallwood's sharp debut novel called The Life of the Mind finds her main character, Dorothy, locked into the stall of a public bathroom. Dorothy spends a lot of time locked in bathrooms. She's having a prolonged miscarriage, which means there are long intervals every day when she's sitting and thinking on the toilet. By profession, Dorothy is a thinker. She's a graduate student in literature, stuck, as she acknowledges, in adjunct professor hell. She teaches up to 4 courses a semester at an elite university, all the while trying and failing to make progress on her dissertation, which appropriately happens to be about female confinement and the Gothic novel. Here's Dorothy ruminating over her stuck position in life. Last fall, there had been 6 job openings in her field. This fall, there had been none. The hiring climate had dried into a dust bowl. She couldn't go on like this, she knew, but she couldn't not go on. She vaguely recalled a time when wanting to do the job she had trained for did not feel like too much to want. Now want itself was a thing of the past. She lived in the epilogue of wants. The Life of the Mind is about endings that dribble to a close. the inexorable erosion of dreams, the slow leak of youthful buoyancy. It's about being youngish at a time in history when it feels like many things might be fading away, including the natural world. The great accomplishment of Smallwood's taut novel is that while it is indeed about all those grim subjects, it's also one of the wittiest, most deliciously farcical novels I've read in a long time. Much of the humor here is rooted in the claustrophobic world of academia, where everyone vies to be the big fish in a shrinking and unsustainably fetid pond. Dorothy had once been a rising star, thanks to a published essay on Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. But after a decade in grad school, she's gone stale, even as she can't imagine what else to do. Which brings us to the extended comic highlight of this novel, the academic conference. Smallwood's genius is to take this professional ritual of cutthroat networking and jargon-encrusted performative presentations and set it in Las Vegas. If a career in academia, especially in the humanities, is a crapshoot, what better site for a conference than this landscape of slot machines, an empty spectacle? Dorothy, as ever, tries hard to have a smart take on Las Vegas, yet the city's pleasure-loving mindlessness defeats her. At the interminable conference, Dorothy runs into her dissertation advisor, a manipulative diva who's the reason why Dorothy has sought out the services of not one, but two therapists simultaneously, one of whom, of course, has a podcast. Dorothy also stumbles into her old grad school boyfriend, who, when they were together, had a kinky predilection for whispering Frank O'Hara poems into, well, not her ear. As I once heard the mystery novelist and humorist Lisa Scottolini say, if it doesn't make you wince, it's not funny. Wince-inducing moments thicken the pages of Smallwood's inventive novel. So too do literary illusions. A degree in the humanities may not be enough to get Dorothy a tenure-track job, but it's undeniably helpful in terms of getting some of the jokes here that involve references to Samuel Beckett and George Eliot's Middlemarch and the work of one of America's first doomsday prophets, Jonathan Edwards. The life of the mind isn't anti-intellectual. It doesn't disparage Dorothy's erudition acquired by years of hard work, and it certainly doesn't exalt the vacuity of Vegas as a symbol of happiness. Instead, the novel takes aim at the kind of reflexive critical thinking that's never turned off. Dorothy overanalyzes everything from doorknobs to stuffed animal toys and makes herself, to paraphrase Hamlet, sick with thought. If only she could learn to laugh sometimes, as this vastly entertaining novel of ideas encourages us readers to do. Her narrow world might expand.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Life of the Mind by Christine Smallwood. Coming up, we'll hear from Reuben Jonathan Miller, author of the new book Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. It's part memoir. His father and brothers have been incarcerated, and Miller spent 4 years in foster care. But it's also a sociological study. He's spent years following the lives of men and women after their release from prison. Mass incarceration has directly affected the life of my guest, Reuben Jonathan Miller. His father and brothers did time, and Miller nearly did. He grew up poor on Chicago's South Side and spent 4 of the first 5 years of his life in foster care after his mother abandoned him and his brothers, leaving them in front of a police station. He was raised by his grandmother, who got custody when he was 5. Now Miller is a sociologist who studies the lives of people after they leave prison and the laws and policies that restrict their lives when they get out. These restrictions have produced what he describes as a new form of citizenship through practices of punishment and exclusion that make it difficult for the formerly incarcerated to get a job or find a place they are legally allowed to live. Their families and loved ones frequently end up being punished by these policies, too. Reuben Jonathan Miller is the author of the new book Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. He teaches at the University of Chicago in the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice. He formerly taught at the University of Michigan and has been a member of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. He started his career counseling children in foster care, then working as a volunteer chaplain in Cook County Prison. His book is based on 15 years of research in Detroit, Chicago, and New York City, following the lives of currently and formerly incarcerated men and women, and talking with their family and friends. Reuben Jonathan Miller, welcome to Fresh Air. There are hundreds and in some cases over 1,000 state laws, not to mention federal laws and policies, restricting people who are released from prison. Describe a few that make it difficult for people getting out of prison who have been convicted of felonies to get back on their feet.
Well, some include the 19,000 laws, policies, and administrative sanctions that prevent people with records from gaining employment. For example, in the state of Illinois, it took a legislative act to allow people with criminal records who were trained as barbers in U.S. jails and prisons to get their cosmetology license. And that law didn't change until 2016. There are thousands of laws like that. And there are additional laws that prevent people, for example, with criminal records from doing things like sitting on a jury. But I think the most insidious of them are the laws that prevent people with records from accessing homes that allow landlords and employers to reject applications based on the fact that people have criminal records.
A lot of the men and women who you followed, they have trouble finding a place to live, and were their families like afraid to take them in because of the consequences the families or loved ones could face?
Every one of the people that I followed about 250 people over the course of the years, spending time with them, trying to understand what life was like for them when they returned home. And everyone, without exception, was unable to rent an apartment in the very beginning on their own without help from others. In most leases, there's a clause that bars people with criminal records from being able to live in the apartment. And since changes in liability law, which happened in about the 1980s, took place, we see that landlords are held responsible for the crimes, for example, that happen on the premises of a building. And their response to that has been to evict people with criminal records. And in fact, to evict families who allow people with criminal records to stay in their homes. And a second strain, the strain that's on families who face the consequence of eviction, would often keep them from spending time with people who care for them most. A great example from the book is from a man named Jimmy. And Jimmy's mother loved him dearly. Jimmy had been in and out of jails and prisons for quite a while, and he was trying to get his life back together. And he would often stay with his mother. Well, her landlord told her, you know, if you let Jimmy stay with you again, I'm going to have to put you out. And so Jimmy, who was effectively alone, you know, at this point, he was sleeping in buildings that were about to be rehabbed. He was, you know, sleeping on couches. But he wouldn't come around his mother because he knew that she would offer him a place to stay. So he stayed away from her because if he stayed there, she would be evicted.
So with your brother Jeremiah, when he got out of prison, he couldn't live with you and you tried to find him a place to stay, but kept running into obstacles. So what is it like when you're trying to help your family and there's real limits and legal limits on what you can do?
It's incredibly frustrating. It's frustrating and it's painful, really, because you're extending yourself to the best of your ability. You know, for example, with my brother, we lived at that time in faculty housing. And in faculty housing, there's a box that you check. And people with criminal records, people with felony records specifically, aren't allowed to live in faculty housing. I offered to cover his rent. I offered to co-sign apartments for him. I offered my word and my reputation even with friends who may have a place for him to stay. And all of those things fell short for one reason or another. The application would still be rejected. Now I've got an inquiry on my credit, say. The landlord may not care that I'm well off and middle class. The fact of my brother's felony record means that they have the right to say no legally. And so they don't take them in. And even friends and family, you know, they put themselves at risk if they allow someone with a criminal record to stay. So even my friends who, for example, owned real estate, owned a building or something like that, or maybe had a spare room in their home, they put themselves at risk. So what we learn is that the probation officer has the right to, for example, raid a home where someone with a felony record lives. It doesn't matter who else is in the home with them. And so it creates this kind of cycle of housing instability that's very hard for people to pull themselves out of.
Your brother Jeremiah, his parole was actually delayed because you couldn't find a place for him to live.
He stayed in prison for several additional months on that, and I felt incredibly guilty. I felt as if I failed him because he ended up doing more time than he would have done because there was no place for him to return to.
And then there's another problem faced both by the person who has left prison and trying to re-enter the world and by their family and friends, is that often in prison, you've accumulated debt, and you've accumulated debt from right before you were sent to prison. And so if you don't have a job and you were poor before you went to prison and you're poor coming out of prison, where are you going to get the money to pay off your debt? And then you have to turn to family and friends to help you. So let's start with the kind of debt that's accumulated before and during prison. And can we use your brother as an example?
Certainly. So my brother was charged $600 to be represented by a public defender whom he met on the day of his conviction for 20 minutes.
Can I just stop you right there? A public defender is supposed to be somebody who you don't have to pay, I thought.
Well, you get charged. The public defender is someone who the courts assigned for you that you don't pay up front. But certainly he was charged for that representation.
Okay, so that's $600, which is a lot of money if you're poor.
It's a lot of money if you're poor. He was charged an additional $1,600 in other court fees. So my presumption is that these things go to cover the cost of the judgment, bailiffs, you know, these sorts of things associated with just general court costs. He was charged an extradition fee. I think that was around $400. This is to get him from, he was arrested in Chicago and transported back to Michigan. So it was the cost of the transport van to get him there. He was charged about $60 for the cost to record his felony record in the state archives. And so most people, by the time they go to a jail or prison, they've already racked up thousands of dollars in legal fees, just like these.
So your brothers did time in prison. Your father spent the better part of 20 years in prison. You can almost say that you were on a prison track when you were a child. Your mother left you and your brothers outside of a police station. She abandoned you there. What is your understanding of why your mother did that?
She had problems. You know, she had problems. She struggled with her own issues. And there were very few resources for a woman who's struggling either with a drug addiction or mental health or even, you know, women who say, have trouble raising their kids. I mean, this is, you know, I was born in 76. I grew up in an era where the so-called welfare queen was scandalized and shamed. You know, it wasn't okay, really, to admit that you didn't know what you were doing. So I don't know. I can't tell you exactly why that happened, but I can tell you that life couldn't have been easy for her.
So you spent four of the first 5 years of your life in foster homes, and then your grandmother was able to get custody. So it sounds like your grandmother, once she took custody of you, really tried to make sure you were educated. She had you read a book a week.
That's absolutely right. We'd each read a book a week. We'd offer an oral book report to her. She made us lip sync Michael Jackson at family functions so that we were comfortable speaking to two people. I think I understood in a deeper way as I grew up how and why she was doing the things that she did. I mean, so now that in the profession of a professor, someone who has to talk to people fairly regularly, I can see why the lip syncing matters. I can see why the reading matters. I can see what she was doing.
So, you know, after working with children in foster care and then working as a volunteer prison chaplain, you became a sociologist. And the work that you've been doing is, you know, researching the lives of prisoners and what happens after they leave prison and all the obstacles to getting a foothold after they leave. Why did you turn from actually directly trying to help prisoners to, you know, basically reporting on them, to researching on them and looking at the bigger picture in a more policy-oriented kind of way through their personal stories?
I initially went to social work school because I wanted to be a better chaplain. And I was interested in helping people a little bit more upstream because I noticed while doing the work as a chaplain that people from my neighborhood, and in fact, people who look just like me, would move in and out of this jail or prison no matter what I did, no matter how many services I referred them to, no matter how much spiritual counseling that I offered, because they had often been exposed to the same things. And because we know that in this country, people are arrested for things that they do, and some people are arrested for nothing. You know, I know kids whose arrest trajectory started at 10 or 11 years old for doing things like standing on a corner, congregating in groups. They're arrested for playing with each other. They're arrested for being on the corner too long when there's nowhere else for them to go. And some people are arrested for coping with trauma and violence in the best ways that they know how, which might be drug use, which might be lashing out. And by the time they eventually commit an actual crime that we would consider a punishable offense, that arrest history will be used against them. They'd say, you've got this long history of arrest, even though you're being caught right now with three crack rocks in your pocket, and maybe you could benefit from treatment, or maybe you could benefit from some counseling or something like that, we see a pattern of criminality. We're going to throw the book at you. You're going to do 3 years in prison, 5 years in prison, something like that. I wanted to know what drives all this stuff. And I wanted to stop thinking so much about the behavior that's expressing itself in the moment and think about some of the root causes and some of the consequences. And so I went to initially social work school because I wanted to be a better chaplain. I thought this is what I wanted to do with my life. And my interest changed, and I started to study mass incarceration and mass incarceration's fallout. So that's sort of how we get to the research trajectory.
Do you feel like you carry around a certain amount of survivor's guilt in the sense that you were the one in your family who made it to the middle class, you teach at a university, you have a new book? I mean, you've been very successful. Your book is getting great reviews. Your brother has been in and out of prison. Is he in prison now?
He's out now, and he's doing well, as well as can be, with support from me and from my loved ones. And no, I don't feel survivor's guilt at all, because I want us all to be free. You know, I my grandmother made me read. My grandmother forced me to give her a book report once a week. My grandmother made me lip sync Michael Jackson with my brother to prepare us to enjoy life and to have a full life. You know, this is the same woman who came up from Louisiana during a wave of the Great Migration and put herself through secretarial school. She came up from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the dead of the South, running from the problems, I'm sure, that were emblematic of that period in time. And she put herself through secretarial school, and it's on no more than $8 an hour. That was at the height of her income, and decided to raise three fairly bad boys who had been left behind. And this woman wanted my success, and I embrace it. And so I don't have survivor's guilt. I also don't look at myself as some super exceptional person. I certainly look at myself as someone who's able to thrive, given the support of my family and the people who love me, because I've been given chances to thrive. And I want those same chances for the brothers and sisters who are locked away in cages right now.
You know, I'm thinking about the question I asked you about whether you have any form of survivor's guilt because you made it into the middle class and have established an important role for yourself, both in the lives of people in prison and coming out and also in the world of sociology. And thinking about my question, I think that's a kind of stupid question to ask. You know, because of course you should feel good and not bad about having, you know, broken out of all of the societal economic traps that are set for the poor.
I appreciate that very much. I want us to think about why we set those traps and whether or not we need those traps. Why do we need those traps? You know, why do we make it so that half of the people in a given family will find themselves locked away? You know, why did we make a world in which 49% of black men will be arrested before they're 23 and 38% of white men will be arrested before they turn 23? I want us to think about all these traps that we've created, we've produced, and I want us to unmake them. That's my hope.
Thank you so much for talking with us. I've really gotten a lot out of your book, and I really appreciated talking with you today. So thank you, and I wish you all good things.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Reuben Jonathan Miller is the author of Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. He teaches at the University of Chicago Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice.